In the early spring of the year 1171, some 75 years after the Crusades struck the Jewish communities along the Rhine River and the Rhine Valley, especially the communities of Speyer, Worms, and Mainz, a Jew by the name of Isaac, the son of Elazar, was watering his horse along the banks of the Loire River as it courses through the town of Blois in north central France. Please turn to text number one, a map of France. If you look on the right side, on the eastern side, you see Paris. And below Paris, southwest of Paris, is the town of Orléans. And southwest of Orléans is the town of Blois. If you look to the left of the word Blois, you see Loire in italics. Loire is a name of the river. That area is known as the Loire Valley. It is a very popular tourist attraction today. It has many castles along the valley. It's a very beautiful part of France. Both Blois and Orléans are on the Loire River. In 1171, in the spring, there is a Jew who is walking along the banks of the Loire River, and he is watering his horse. It was dusk, and the edge of an animal skin that he was carrying slipped out from under his cloak. At the same time, there was a Christian servant who also was coming to the water to water his horse. But when the Christian's horse saw the whiteness of the protruding hide coming out of the Jew's cloak in the hazy darkness, the horse became frightened. The Christian immediately went to his master and reported that just now, on the banks of the Loire River, I saw a Jew who was disposing of the corpse of a Christian child. Now, this charge that Jews killed Christian children and disposed their corpses is not a new one. Known as the ritual murder accusation, it began a number of years earlier. The first example that we have is from Norwich in England in 1144. Norwich is spelled differently than it sounds. In 1168, the next town is Gloucester, also spelled differently than it sounds, also in England. So we have two examples of ritual murder accusations beginning in England in the middle of the 12th century. Now in 1171 is the first time that we have it in continental Europe. It's also different because in the two previous times, there was actually a body of a dead Christian child that was deposited and then discovered in a Jewish home. And so there was allegedly evidence. This time, no body was ever discovered. The Christian alleged that the Jew threw the body into the water. Nevertheless, for all kinds of reasons, this charge was taken very seriously. And less than 3 months later, on the 20th of the month of Sivan, and I'm going to repeat that date because that date will occupy us for the remainder of this lecture series, on the 20th of the month of Sivan, which was May 26th in the year 1171, some either 31 or 32 or 33, the manuscript evidence is not exactly clear, Jews were killed in Blois as a punishment for this sin, which was never proven. For some reason, this became very important. It became was taken very seriously. And one thing leads to another, and the Jews are punished. 31, 32, 33 Jews are killed on one day on the 20th of Sivan in 1171 in Blois. This event is a complex one and has merited a great deal of scholarly attention and will occupy us for the remainder of this presentation. It is first described, or in one place where it's described, is in Sefer Zechira. Sefer Zechira means Book of Memory, that was written by a scholar, a rabbi by the name of Ephraim of Bonn, B-O-N-N, in Germany, who wrote a work describing some dozen tragic events that occurred to Jews in Western Europe in the last part of the 12th century. So it's a book of remembering, and it's devoted to after the First Crusade, after the Second Crusade. Second Crusade was in 1147. So from the duration of the last part of the 12th century, tragedy after tragedy, event after event, they're all described in this book of memory, the book of remembrance, Sefer Zechira, by Rabbi Ephraim of Bonn. Text number 2. Let's take a look at some of this material. What shall we say before God? What shall we speak? How can we justify ourselves? God must have found out our iniquity. Here it is again, our way of saying, well, it must have been our fault. I want to make it clear in light of the previous presentation and future presentations that one of the ways that the Jews made it possible to continue to have a relationship with God, in spite of all of this terrible challenge and tragedy, is to say that it's not that God broke the deal. It's not that God removed himself from the Jewish people and that the relationship is over, but that it's our fault, that we didn't live up to the deal. We didn't behave properly. And so therefore, God does what God always does, and that is, if you don't behave properly, then there are consequences. And precisely the notion that it's our fault, while it becomes really difficult, and I think for moderns in particular, this is hard to really internalize, but it's also very helpful conceptually to try to maintain the paradigm of the covenantal construct. And so here we have it just in passing. Oh my God, God discovered that we're not doing something right, and this is what happened. In the year 1171, evil appeared in France too, and great destruction in the city of Blois, in which at that time there lived about 40 Jews. 40 Jews live in Blois. I told you up to the highest amount is 33 who were killed on the 20th of Sivan. It happened on that evil day, Thursday, towards evening, that the terror came upon us. A Jew rode up to water his horse. A common soldier, may he be blotted out of the book of life, was also there watering the horse of his master. The Jew bore on his chest an untanned hide, but one of the corners had become loose and was sticking out of his coat. When in the gloom the soldier's horse saw the white side of the hide, it was frightened and sprang back and could not be brought to water. The Christian servant hastened back to his master and said, "Hear, my lord, what a certain Jew did. As I rode behind him toward the river in order to give your horses a drink, I saw him throw a little Christian child, whom the Jews have killed, into the water. When I saw this, I was horrified and hastened back quickly for fear he might kill me too. Even the horse under me was so frightened by the splash of the water when he threw the child in that it would not drink." One thing leads to another. The bottom of the page, the ruler starts negotiating for a monetary settlement. Very often in the Middle Ages, the ruler used this as an opportunity to extract money from the Jews. Oh, you want to stay? Oh, you don't want to be killed, so you have to pay. And he starts to use this as a chance to be able to line his pockets. But then, next page, in the meantime, a priest arrives. The priest says, No, you can't let the Jews off the hook. This is a terrible thing. And you have to make sure that they get severely punished. In the meantime, the priest arrived on the scene, and from this time on, the ruler paid no attention to the Jews, did not listen to them. The Jews were offering to pay in order to be able to extricate themselves from this horrific situation, but he only listened to the instruction of the priest. In the day of wrath, money could not help them. At the wicked ruler's command, they were taken and put into a wooden house around which they placed thorn bushes and faggots. As they were led forth, they were told, save your lives, leave your religion, even up to the last minute. They were given this choice, this opportunity to convert to Christianity and save themselves. They mistreated them, beat them, tortured them, hoping that they would exchange their Jewish glorious religion for something that the Jews considered to be worthless, but the Jews refused. Rather, did they encourage each other and say to one another, no, 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 we have to be strong. We cannot be allowed to be forcibly converted to Christianity, and we have to continue to maintain our faith in God. The next page, about 5-6 lines from the top, this happened in the year 4931 on Wednesday, the 20th of the month of Sivan. This day ought to be established as a fast day like the fast of Gedalia. The fast of Gedalia is a reference to what we saw in the second session in the book of Zechariah, the fast of the seventh month. Gedaliah, as is indicated here, was a governor of Judea after the destruction of the first temple. Didn't last very long. He was killed, and there was a special fast day already biblically referenced that was established to commemorate his murder. It's a very bad day. It's a fast day. A fast day should be established now. It's worthy that we should have a fast day established for what happened in Blois in 1171. The fast day should take place on the 20th of Sivan. If we're going to fast, it's clear when we should fast because all of them were killed on the same day. And it's so egregious that we should actually establish a fast day. It ought to be established. Ra'ui likov'o. It is worthy that we should have a fast day. All these facts were written down by the Jews of Orléans. I showed you earlier that Orléans was upriver from Blois. That was the next closest largest Jewish community. Orléans was also the town where probably the greatest rabbinic scholar of the generation lived, and his name was Jacob. He's known as Rabbeinu Tam. Jacob Tam, he was the grandson of Rashi, one of the great, probably the greatest luminary of his generation. He lived in Orléans. Happens that he passed away just a few weeks later. He died in 1171, but Orléans was a very prominent city, and the Jews in Orléans wrote down what happened. That was the closest city. There was nobody left in Blois anymore. The vast majority of the community was killed. The others ran away. They succeeded in escaping. And made known to our master, Rabbi Jacob, Rashi's grandson, the greatest French rabbi of his day. It was also reported in that letter, and we'll see a piece of that letter in a moment, that as the flames mounted high, the martyrs began to sing in unison a melody that began softly but ended with a full voice. The Christians came and asked us, what kind of a song is this? We never heard such a sweet melody, and we knew what it was. And that was Aleinu, Aleinu l'shabeach. That is a major prayer that's recited generally at the end of the service. And originally it was instituted to be recited only on the high holidays, and then it became incorporated into the daily prayer book. But at this time, it was still considered to be something unique and particularly significant as the Jews were walking to the pyre, P-Y-R-E, they were singing this song. O daughters of Israel, weep for the 31 souls that were burned for the sanctification of the name, and let your brothers, the entire house of Israel, bewail the burning. Because of our sins, here it is again, these men were not given a Jewish burial, but were left at the bottom of the hill on the very spot where they had been burnt. It was only later the Jews came and buried their bones. There were about 32 holy souls. So first you have 31, and now you have 32. It's not clear exactly what the number was. So here we have, 75 years or so after the Crusades, the Crusaders killed, we don't know exactly how many. We used to think many, many more than we think now. Generally speaking, it's really hard to identify specific numbers in pre-modern times. They didn't have a fancy census. Some of you may know that even now we're coming up to a census in the United States, and there's all kinds of discussion about how we're going to make sure that we get the right number. So you can just imagine that in pre-modern times, they had no idea how they were going to get the right number. You can also understand that the chronicles exaggerate, or just thousands upon thousands, hundreds of thousands. We're going to see this again in unit number six, when we talk about the Chmelnytsky massacres, 30,000 Jews in this town and 60,000 Jews in this town. Well, there weren't even a tenth of the number of those Jews who lived in any of these towns. So it's really hard to say. We used to think tens of thousands were killed, then we thought 10,000. The most prominent contemporary Jewish scholar of the Crusades told me that he thinks it was 3,000. 3,000 Jews were killed during the time of the Crusades. So 3,000 doesn't seem like a lot, but 3,000 is an eternity. 3,000 Jews is just unbelievable. But now, here, we're talking about 33 Jews. Now, 33 Jews is awful, is terrible. But 33 Jews is still less than 3,000 Jews. You remember that when it came to 3,000 Jews, Kalonymus said, we don't add any days of fasting, we do everything on Tisha B'Av. Now, 75 years later, we have evidence where somebody says, Rabbi Ephraim of Bonn, you know what? We really should have a fast day on the 20th of Sivan to commemorate the destruction of 31, 32, or 33 Jews. Text number three. This is the letter that was sent by the Jews of Orléans to the Jewish community at large. They were the ones who were closest to Blois. You saw it on the map. They found out what happened. They wanted to let the Jewish world know. And it's about a 6, 7, 8 page letter in English translation. This is how the letter begins. Let's take a look at the third paragraph. From the time he gave over his people, capital H, capital H, talking about God, from the time that God gave over his people to destruction and set fire to our temple, holy ones such as these have not been offered up as a sacrifice. Nothing has happened that has been so egregious since the time of the temple. Since the temple was destroyed, now, just skipped over the Crusades and skipped over all kinds of other persecutions. It's never been as bad. Not so many great Jews, holy ones, have been offered up as right now. These angels of the Lord, they were angels of the Lord. They were pure, they were pious, they were holy, they were just transcendental, went up in flame. This is perceived of as a sacrifice. Throughout medieval literature, we see this in the Crusade Chronicles and elsewhere, Jews dying, and in this particular case being burnt, is a sacrifice to God. Again, modern ears finds this extremely difficult, and I understand that, and I appreciate that. But this is how it was perceived of. Again, it's all in a desire to somehow maintain the construct of the covenantal relationship. Not that God turned his face for some reason. We don't get it. We don't understand it. We're upset. We're angry. We're distraught. We're beside ourselves. For some reason, this fits into some kind of a sacrificial paradigm. These angels of the Lord went up in flames, 31 angels. Here we have the number 31. Earlier we saw 31, 32. Elsewhere it's 33. These angels went up in flames and they stand before God. Now, when the oppressor ordered them taken out and burned, as men said, the Christians in Blois who were responsible for this persecution, tragedy, murder, said, let us call them and ask them, perhaps they will abandon their God. Once again, here's your option. Abandon God, see the truth, become a Christian, you're good to go, and you'll be safe. The Jews answered unanimously, no, we will cling to God, the God of Israel. Him we shall fear with all our hearts and all our souls. The Jews were taken out and the Gentiles watched them closely. Perhaps one of them might waver. Up to the last second, they're looking, maybe we can get a couple of them over, the Christians said, to our side. But the Jews said to one another, not gonna happen. Shall we tremble over this fire? Is not this day for which we were chosen? No, we have to do it. We have faith in God. We're going to commit ourselves to God and to nothing else. Then they said as they went forth, take care lest your heart be seduced. They strengthen one another. Don't waver. Don't give in. Strengthen yourself and let us be firm in the fear of our Creator so that our death may serve as atonement for all our sins. Here it is. Mita mechaperet. Our death should serve as an atonement. Clearly it's our fault. God loves us. God is doing whatever God does. God doesn't behave in any way differently than he used to behave. It's our fault. We're responsible. We're getting what we deserve. Indeed, these are the sufferings of the community through which all Israel achieves atonement. Next sentence, God inhaled this sacred incense. Again, the sacrificial imagery. On the fourth day of the week, it was a Wednesday. So just remember Wednesday, the fourth day of the week, on the 20th of the month of Sivan in the year 1171. And here it is again. It is fitting that this day be established as a fast day for all our people. That phrase is extremely important. Highlight it now, we're going to come back to it. Hebrew, and I'll translate it, or I already did translate it, V'ra'ui l'kov'o tzom. It is appropriate to establish a fast day. L'chol b'nei amenu. L'chol b'nei amenu. For all of our people. All of those who identify as Jews. And the significance of this fast will even be greater than the fast of Gedalia, which I described a moment ago. It is a veritable day of atonement. The Day of Atonement is a biblical fast in the Torah. That's the other ones, the fast of the fourth and the fifth, that comes later on in the prophets. The fast of the Day of Atonement is a serious fast day. It's a biblical fast day. This is like a Day of Atonement. It's worthy that we should have a fast day. It's worthy that we should have a fast day for whom? L'chol b'nei amenu. Take a look in text number 4. I'm sorry, I had no English translation, and I'm just going to point to, on the second page of text number 4, to line number 32. This is, and I'm bringing it to you because I want to show it to you, and I want to show it to you in the original. This is an elegy that was written by the brother of Ephraim of Bone, namely Hillel of Bone. So this was obviously a very precocious family. And we have here two brothers who are very well-spoken and well-written. Ephraim of Bone writes a history book. We'll come back to him in a moment. His brother writes an elegy. It's known as Emunei Shalomei Yisrael. This elegy became extremely important because it was inserted into the prayer book for recital on Yom Kippur, on the Day of Atonement. Part of the service, of the afternoon service of the Day of Atonement, is when there's a whole reference to the 10 martyrs. There's a whole martyrological section of the afternoon service on the Day of Atonement. And we talk about the martyrs, the 10 martyrs, those who were killed during the Hadrianic persecutions of the second century. There's a whole prayer, there's a whole reference, a whole liturgical poem about them inserted into the prayer book, the machzor of Yom Kippur, which is recited in the afternoon service. And this was inserted after 1171, right there as a later iteration, example of martyrology. Jews in Blois, in 1171, they gave up their lives for God. And on line 32, in this passage on the second page, Re'uyim likboa Tzom utfilot. It is worthy. Once again, it's the same language. Ra'ui likovo tzom. It is worthy. It is appropriate. It's the right thing to do that we should have a fast day for this event. So we have now three sources of evidence. This is so bad. This is so egregious. Nothing like this has happened since the destruction of the temple. You know what? It's appropriate. It would be right. It would be right if we would have a fast day. We should have a fast day. It's a day of atonement. We should have a fast day, a separate fast day. And we should have a separate fast day for the entire Jewish people. Now please go back to text number 2, the last paragraph of text number two. It's page 145 in the book that I copied it from. We're back now to the Sefer Zechira, to the book of memory written by Ephraim Abon. So after in the previous paragraphs he says, and he wrote, that it happened on Wednesday the 20th of Sivan, the day ought to be established a fast day, he in fact tells us that that is exactly what happened. That in fact, not just ought, but it actually happened, and it actually was a fast day. Last paragraph, of their own free will, all the communities of France, England, and the Rhineland, all the communities, France, England, and the Rhineland. Jews are living in France, Jews are living in England. There was no such thing as Germany yet. Germany is a modern invention. The country called Germany was known as the Rhineland. Germany until modern times or early modern times was a collection of all kinds of principalities, and maybe 40, 45 of them. It's known as the Rhineland. So Jews are living there, and Jews are living in England. Jews don't get expelled from England until 1290. That's going to be the next unit. We're going to talk about the expulsion of the Jews from England. Jews are living in England. Jews are living in France. Jews are living in the Rhineland. And I don't know how many Jews, but a lot of Jews, not local Jews. Obviously, the Jews in Blois couldn't fast because there were no Jews left in Blois. But we're talking about countries, Jews in this country and in this country and in this country. That's a lot of Jews. That's a lot of countries. That's a lachol b'nei amenu. That's for, Jews are fasting of their own free will. All the communities of France, England, and the Rhineland, all the communities observed Wednesday. Here it is again, Wednesday, the 20th of Sivan, 1171, as a day of mourning and fasting. They themselves realized that this would be an appropriate thing to do. This was also the command of our great teacher, Jacob, the son of Rabbi Meir. I mentioned his name earlier. He was living in Orléans, next door, the greatest rabbi of that generation. He also commanded, who wrote letters to them, informing them that it was proper to fix this day as a fast for all our people, and it must be even greater than the fast of Gedalia, it's a day of Yom Kippur. And the concluding words are, for some reason, not translated here, but I'll read them to you. These are the words that our master wrote, and that thus it is proper, and thus did the Jews accept it. So the Jews accepted this fast day, where? In England, France, and the Rhineland, because they felt it was the right thing to do, and perhaps more significantly, because the greatest rabbi of the generation told them that he thought that this was proper and appropriate, and they did it. So now we have evidence. 31, 32, 33 Jews are killed. A fast day is established, and a fast day is observed in a multinational context by a lot of Jews, for a tragic event that happened 75 years after the Crusades. We now have another paradigm. The other paradigm is, we do have fast days. We do have national fast days. Colonimus is not taken into account. For 3,000 Jews or 10,000 Jews who were killed during the Crusades, Colonimus says, it's very sad. As a matter of fact, it's super sad. As a matter of fact, it's the equivalent of the destruction of the temple. But we don't make new fast days. We're going to do it on the day that is set aside already earlier to commemorate the destruction of the temple. To use this language, we're going to subsume it under the ninth of Av. And now all of a sudden, less than a century later, we're off and running. New tragedy, 33 Jews, new fast day, new fast day. France, England, and the Rhineland. Now, it has been pretty much proven, argued, and mostly accepted by scholars that Rabbi Ephraim of Bonn was wrong. The scholarly assumption is, and I accept it, and I support it, is that, in fact, there never was a fast day that was established on the 20th of Sivan for what happened in Blois. For all kinds of reasons, scholars are skeptical about the historical veracity of this tradition. He says that they accepted it on their own, Rabbeinu Tam told them to. Not likely. We don't have any other evidence anywhere else, not in the 13th century, the 14th century, the 15th century. We have no evidence anywhere from any source that Jews ever fasted anywhere until we come to the 17th century for another matter on the 20th of Sivan. So normally we're skeptical because just because I don't see it doesn't mean it didn't exist. There is a Hebrew phrase, lo ra'inu eino ra'aya. Just the fact that I didn't see it doesn't prove. Not seeing something doesn't prove. But here it's pretty dispositive. Here it's pretty clear that it really did not happen. There really was not such a fast. But what's fascinating for me and for us and for this conversation is that ultimately it doesn't matter. Ultimately it doesn't matter whether there was or there wasn't. What ultimately matters is that they thought that there was. And that they were comfortable in asserting that there was. That to me is what's significant. They were prepared to say, you know what, we really should have a fast day. And Rabbi Ephraim Rabban was prepared to say and did say, you know what, we had a fast day. So you'll quibble and you'll technical and you'll be a historian and you'll go and you'll look at the source and say, nah, I don't really think there was. But conceptually, they're ready to establish a fast day. And they thought that the greatest rabbi of the generation actually did establish a fast day. And a fast day for the whole people, for everybody, for all the Jews, or a large number of Jews, more than just a local community, more than just the Jews of Orléans decided because they were the neighboring community and the Jews of Blois are gone. So how are we going to remember the Jews of our, the tragedy of our neighbors, the Jews that were killed in Blois? Well, we'll fast for them on the day that they were killed. No, we're talking about France and England and the Rhineland. So it doesn't matter for our purposes whether or not practically speaking, historically, factually, they fasted. Conceptually, they were there. Conceptually, they were absolutely prepared to do so. And it's more than a local fast day. L'chol b'nei amenu. Nowhere here do we see the colonimus impulse to subsume under the tragedy of the destruction of the temples. Nowhere do we have an assumption, ein lehosif mo'ed shever v'taveira. Nowhere do we see here, oh no, you know what, blah, blah, 20th of Sivan, yeah, I know it's terrible, so we're going to take the story of the 20th of Sivan and we're going to put it into the 9th of Av, and on the 9th of Av, will also fast for and commemorate the tragedy of what happened during Blois. They simply assumed then that a new, even a national fast day could be established when they felt that it should be warranted, totally oblivious to any concern that would militate in favor of them subsuming this new tragedy or any subsequent tragedy under the overarching centrality of the memory of the temple's destruction. New catastrophe occurs, a fast day is established, separate, irrelevant from the fast day of the 9th of Av that was established for the destruction of the temple. And so we have our second fundamental crux of this entire series, and that is, yep, we do have fasts. We actually do have fasts. On the one hand, the Crusade legacy, colonimus, is no national fast days. Everything is subsumed, even if it's very significant. It's equal to the destruction of the temple. Now we have, a mere less than a century later, an entirely different perspective. Something happens, it's terrible, we're going to have a fast day. It's worthy for us to have a fast day. We think we actually had a fast day. They didn't have any problem thinking that there was a fast day because their perception was it's okay to have a fast day. Now, I just want to jump ahead to anticipate in the last two sessions, we will talk about the Holocaust. We're going to see that when it came to the Holocaust, so how are we going to commemorate the Holocaust? What are we going to do about the Holocaust? So there are those who said, well, Kolonimus. They quote Kolonimus. And they say, well, you can't have not just a separate fast day, you can't have a separate day of commemoration even for the Holocaust. Tisha B'Av is it. Tisha B'Av is the day that we remember every subsequent Jewish day. I mean, Kolonimus said that we don't add days of sadness, and so we're going to remember it on Tisha B'Av. There were others who said, and we're going to see this both in a speech that was given in the Knesset when there was a debate about the establishment of Yom HaShoah, a Holocaust Memorial Day, and in some of the rabbinic materials surrounding what happened in that conversation. Others said, no, wait a minute, we have a precedent. And the precedent is the 20th of Sivan. The 20th of Sivan is held up as a counter to the Kolonimus. And both of them, Kolonimus on this end and 20th of Sivan on this end, are reduced in the debate when it comes to the commemoration of the Holocaust. So can we have a separate day of commemoration of the Holocaust or not? The only way I believe that we can understand the dynamics of the issue that was being confronted after the Holocaust, both before as well as after the founding of the State of Israel, is to understand the pre-modern dynamic. I believe in general that the only way we could understand what's going on in today's world is if we have a context and if we have a perspective. You can't understand Jewish-Christian relations in the first part of the 21st century. You can't begin to understand what's going on now unless you know what was going on during the Middle Ages. You have to understand the dynamics of what existed in this relationship to appreciate what I consider to be just cataclysmic changes, light years different. You can't understand, for us now, much more relevant, the Jewish-Muslim encounter, debate, tension that's going on now, particularly we're so much more sensitive to it in the context of the State of Israel. You can't really understand it unless you understand where this encounter lived in pre-modern times. And in pre-modern times, there were moments of tension, but the Jewish-Muslim encounter was, on the whole, pretty much a positive one. It wasn't peachy, rosy, perfect, wonderful, magnificent. There were moments of great difficulty. But on the whole, there was what we call the golden age of Spain, what we call the symbiosis, what we call the connection, the convivencia. What's happening today is a distortion of a age-old, much more positive, warmer, closer encounter between Jews and Muslims. With Christianity, it's the opposite. What's happening today is much better, much more positive than it was. So I firmly believe, and that's why I spend so much of my time and my life and my energy trying to understand pre-modern Jewish history, not just because pre-modern Jewish history, I believe, is important, but at the end of the day, we're living now. And in order to help us better appreciate and understand what's going on now, I believe that we need to understand what was going on then. And here is a perfect example. To understand what's going on when it comes to the Holocaust, and to understand the language of the discussion of what's going on when it comes to the Holocaust. And what I mean is not the history of the Holocaust, the events of the Holocaust, but I'm focusing specifically on the aftermath, on the commemoration of the Holocaust. So the Holocaust happened. So now what am I going to do to remember it? The only way we can understand that is to appreciate that it's building on and building off of pre-modern paradigms. And here I've tried to outline for you two opposite, mutually exclusive approaches, both of which are going to figure very prominently when it comes to that conversation. On the one hand, the propensity to subsume, and we're going to associate that repeatedly with Kolonimus, and Kolonimus comes back and is referred to. I told you that his elegy that is made its way into the prayer book for the 9th of Av is very, very accepted. Everybody knows Kolonimus. Anybody who reads that book knows about Kolonimus. It comes up all over. At the same time, the other side, the anti-Kolonimus side, also has pre-modern anchor, and that is repeatedly what happened on the 20th of Sivan, or, to be more precise, what was perceived of as having happened on the 20th of the month of Sivan. But I want to make one final point, and that's a real irony. And that is that the 20th of Sivan, I keep on presenting to you as sort of the anti-subsuming statement. It's the model of not subsuming. It's the model of new event, new tragedy, new fast. It's going to turn out, and I will show you this in the sixth session, that the day that's set aside as an example of anti-subsuming itself becomes a day of subsuming. There's going to be a whole discussion we'll see in unit number 6 about when should we commemorate the Khmelnytsky massacres. When should we commemorate? So somebody says, you know when we should commemorate the Khmelnytsky massacres? I think we should commemorate the Khmelnytsky massacres on the 20th of Sivan. You know why? Because in Blois, on the 20th of Sivan, we have a tradition that they used to fast. So you know what? I don't really know exactly when we should commemorate what happened in Khmelnytsky, because Khmelnytsky lasted a year and a half, so I don't know when. Let's do it on that day. They fasted already on the 20th of Sivan, so we're going to fast for this on the 20th of Sivan. That's really amazing. They did not say, oh my God, we have the 9th of Av, let's fast on the 9th of Av. They didn't say that. They said, oh, we have the 20th of Sivan, that's already in place, so let's going to fast on the 20th of Sivan. So the very day, which stands for anti-subsuming, itself becomes a day under which later events and tragedies are subsumed. Which means that this idea, the propensity, the impulse to somehow link this to that is so great that it's even going to be expressed on a day which stands for the opposite of that impulse. I think that's an irony that is really significant and worthy of attention. We will see that there were many other fast days that were established. Seems to me that the verdict of the Jewish historical experience was more on the 20th of Sivan model than it was on the Kolonimus model. We will see more and more fast days that were established for subsequent tragedies, not just local fast days, there were many local fast days, but even beyond local fast days that were established to commemorate subsequent Jewish tragedies. And it is to those beginning in the 13th century that we will devote our attention to in our next presentation. The Talmud is put on trial, the Talmud is found guilty, and some 2 years later in 1242, some 24 wagon loads full of manuscripts, of Hebrew manuscripts, primarily the Talmud, are burnt in Paris.